This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Shall we begin?
Expecto Patronum!
Hey, Bombe!
To do what I do, I need some idea of the threat we face.
As I understand it, we're trying to prevent World War III.
Nuclear holocaust?
No. Something worse.
All I have for you is a word.
Tell it.
It'll open the right doors, some of the wrong ones, too.
You have to start looking at the world in a new way.
Hello, everyone. You are listening to Popcorn Culture. It is 7:38 and I'm Lee Chui Lin coming to you from home along with Sharmila Ganesan and Arvind Yuvaraj, who is actually in the studio. Hi, guys.
Hello. This is one of the weirdest setups I've ever been in. But the things we do.
I mean, a movie show where we're all on screens, there's something quite poetic about it, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah.
Poetic, sad, I mean, take your pick. So this is actually our first supercut in a while. We've been doing some watch from home episodes talking about what we've been watching from home, but this is the first time back in regular programming. And considering we're back and also just the state of the world in general with economies reopening, blah, 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 we thought that today would be a good time to talk about reboots. So we're going to be focusing on franchises and shows and careers shortly, but we are going to be starting off with news about the industry itself. Before that, though, let us know whether you enjoy reboots, what your favorites have been, what your least favorites have been even. You can WhatsApp 018-789-8899 and tweet us at BFM Radio. So what you heard there was, of course, the big drama of Tenet, which is the eagerly anticipated Christopher Nolan release, currently still scheduled to premiere in July. And it's being positioned as the blockbuster that is going to save 2020 from itself, I suppose. And right now, I think it is the last big holdout that is refusing to budge on the premiere date.
Yeah, I mean, Bond moved to, I think, next year. Mulan is, Mulan has been shifted tentatively to the late July, but they're not committing to the date fully. But no, Christopher Nolan is as committed as his filmmaking. He's holding on to saving the summer.
And I think the studios are sort of based on that article in Variety, I think, or Vulture. It said that studios are actually waiting for Nolan to come out with Tenet so it can sort of boost business, and they're going to put it in more screens or on more screens, in more cinemas, even with physical distancing and stuff. So I don't know. It's wrong on so many levels and for so many reasons. But on a very personal level, I don't want to have to decide if I can go to the cinema to watch Tenet. I don't want them to stick to the release date because I don't want to have that sort of dilemma of should I go and see it because it's a Nolan film, or should I stay at home and do the responsible thing if it's going to be a packed hall, even if there's like physical distancing. So that's on like personal basis. Also, I don't know why the rush to see so many new movies. I mean, I understand business is business, but this whole thing of, you know, bringing out new stuff and just packing people in small halls and, you know, seeing if it works, why not just test the waters before opening up, like, for such a big blockbuster, especially for something like Tenet?
And July doesn't feel like it's very long away, does it? I mean, we're already mid-May, so I'm on board with you. I'm very excited about Tenet. I have been since I first saw the trailer. Mm-hmm. I love Christopher Nolan's films. But even that, I'm not sure is enough to convince me to, especially if the situation hasn't changed very much from now. I don't necessarily know that. And I don't want to make that very difficult position of, I'm not going to watch it in the cinema. I'll just wait for whenever I can watch it on a smaller screen, which is It's kind of going to break my heart.
No, but that's the thing. If you don't see Tenet in the cinema, then I think there's no point watching it anywhere else because it's a Nolan film. You know what I mean?
No, I don't agree with that necessarily. No? So I think that Christopher Nolan is one of the huge filmmaking holdouts when it comes to streaming, right? He's long been a big lover of cinema and the theatre. He thinks of theatre as a social commitment, a social contract. He also is always very particular about the kind of film he shoots on, the kind of viewing experience he wants you to have. So I understand that, but I don't think that just because I like your work, I have to buy into that. I should be able to consume things however and whenever I want to. And yes, it would be best to watch Tenet on the big screen. It would be best to watch it in the best way possible. I presume that would be IMAX. But I think that I don't want to necessarily feel that if I miss out on the cinematic experience, I'm missing out entirely. I mean, I miss cinema so badly. I love the communal experience of it all. But I think that a good movie and an event movie should be able to hold up to the pressure of not being seen in the cinema, if that's what happens.
Since we're talking about this, like, when would you guys feel safe to go back? I mean, we don't know because no one knows. But when cinemas open, like, how long would you give it before you're like, okay, you know, I can go and sit in a crowded space and maybe watch a movie? And what movie would compel you to go watch it?
I think Tenet comes pretty close to something that would compel me, but July is way too early, I think. It would also entirely depend on the kind of measures that the cinemas are putting in place and whether I have confidence that they're actually holding to the things that they were saying. I mean, I know they were saying before we went into full MCO mode that there were already things that various cinemas here were introducing, you know, things like distance seating or making sure that people wore masks and so on and so forth. So it's not a total lost cause. In some ways, I feel like a controlled environment like a cinema is actually more comfortable for me than, say, like doing my grocery shopping every week.
For sure. But I do want to say, though, that if you think about it in the context of how we normally view interruptions in the cinema, by that I mean people sneezing or coughing or clearing their throats, the normal sounds of lots of people in a cinema. I think that that's just a new element that perhaps filmmakers haven't thought of. Because even if you have the world's healthiest people all in one room, if you're eating popcorn, you're going to clear your throat. And I think that that's going to be a bigger distraction than it used to be, because we're also sensitive, hypersensitive, in fact, to these sounds. So to your question, Arvind, I don't know. I think I will probably go back earlier than I think I will. Meaning, like, if you ask me now, I'd tell you some ludicrous time, but probably it'll be sooner than that, you know. I think, and Tenet would do it. I just don't want to feel like my arm is being twisted. And I guess the other big thing to cover before we move on from news entirely is that the Academy Awards have shifted their judging criteria from previously you have to have been shown in a Los Angeles cinema for at least a week. And now they're actually going to be including movies that debut on streaming or on-demand platforms, which is a big battle that the Academy has been having with the likes of Netflix over the last few years. And so this is, I mean, a pretty big shift, even if it is prompted by a pandemic.
And it took a pandemic to get the Oscars Academy to shift. And it's a big thing, right? Because they are notoriously slow to taking on change. They are, you know, constantly two steps behind any kind of progress. Even Martin Scorsese, you know, had gone to Netflix before the Oscars did. So I think it's a, you know, in the midst of a lot of crappiness otherwise, I think it's a good shift. And it's a shift that happened because it had to. But it's interesting, though.
Isn't it a very stubborn way of thinking, though? I mean, even if it took them this long, and they've also given a sort of like short, small window saying that they will allow movies that came out on streaming during the lockdown. But the moment it lifts, then they won't recognize streaming anymore unless they show in cinemas, which is it's kind of a weird thing to hold on to, especially now, because the movies that need to be seen on the big screen are normally big blockbusters. And big blockbusters don't get recognized by the Academy. The Academy recognizes movies that show for like a limited time and that you could watch at home. And I've seen during the MCO, I've been able to see like a bunch of A24 movies, like binge on A24 stuff. all like really good movies. None of them showed here. Like none of them opened in cinemas. None of them showed long enough for me to catch them, or they just don't have like, you know, worldwide releases and stuff. So those are the movies that the Academy recognizes. But if those movies are showing in cinemas, no one's going to see them anyway. That's just the truth. So it's a weird, it's sort of a very old school stubborn thing to hold on to. And it's kind of, it kind of makes them look silly, I think.
It's also a loophole because they can just, they just really need to open in a Los Angeles screen for a short amount of time. So it's also a very elitist and kind of easily mended by the people who have access to those things, which is inherently unfair.
Elitist, old-fashioned, stubborn, all surprising words to use for the Academy. How dare we? Okay, so we're talking today about reboots because this is a reboot of our live Supercut, albeit from home. And also because I think as economies and industries are thinking about how to restart, we thought it would be a good time to focus on films. So we've spoken about Tenet, the stubborn blockbuster that could, that's refusing to budge from its release date. We have also talked about the fact that the Academy Awards are now going to recognize movies that actually debut on streaming, which is new. And we'd like to know, what are your thoughts? Would you go back into the cinema in July for Christopher Nolan's Tenet? What are your favorite reboots? What have your least favorites been? You can let us know. WhatsApp 018-789-8899. You can tweet us at BFM Radio. If you want, you can also call 7733-2900. We're going to be right back with movie franchise reboots right after this. Keep it here on Popcorn Culture, BFM 89.9.
Bodacious, fabulous minds. BFM 89.9, the business station.
Apes! Do not want war, but will fight if we must. Ape! Home! Human! Soul!
It is 7:50 in the evening. You're listening to Popcorn Culture with Lynn, Arvin, and Sharmila. And today, we are spending our Supercut talking about reboots. Firstly, looking at whether the industry is ready to reboot. And now, looking at the good old-fashioned sense of the word. What makes a good reboot, especially in terms of movies and movie franchises? So to be clear, I think when... Oh, before that, before we dive in. Guys, let us know. I mean, are you ready to go back to cinemas yet? And also, what have been your favorite and least favorite reboots, whether in terms of film or TV? You can WhatsApp 018-789-8899. You can tweet us at BFM Radio, and you can call 7733-2900. So, when we were talking about reboots, we have to be quite clear, we're not talking about remakes.
Yes. So reboot essentially pivots from a particular storyline, starting, setting in place either new characters or new story, new versions of the characters. So not like a remake. And I recognize that that line can seem a little gray sometimes, but we can kind of figure things out as we go along as well, I think.
I think a good example would be the Spider-Man franchise, because that's been rebooted twice. So there's the Tobey Maguire one, then there's the then the Andrew Garfield one, and then now the Tom Holland one. So that's a reboot because it goes back and sort of rejigs the whole timeline and starts fresh. Whereas
Uncle Ben again.
Yeah, Uncle Ben again.
Technically, Batman and Superman are all reboots as well. Because every time they have a new actor, they don't retain the storyline or the the Alfreds and everything in the previous ones.
Yeah, but whereas like Disney's live action stuff, like Lion King's a remake, but Aladdin's a remake and a reboot because now that's its own franchise because there's Aladdin 2.
So much needlessness. And I think that that's a crucial point to raise, actually, the fact that reboots often try to kickstart some new form of a franchise. They try to sell you on the fact that there will be sequels, or at the very least, there will be merchandise, ha-cha-cha. So reboots are very specific. And I thought before we dive into that, we could talk about what makes a good reboot. What makes it... I guess what's the formula that makes it work? And I think that it is a really, really tough one because... because we lack so much in original storytelling, or rather in original characters, original stories these days, it's hard for me at the moment to think of ways to justify a reboot.
I think the clip we started this segment with, Planet of the Apes, is actually an excellent, excellent example of why a reboot should exist. Primarily, and the Planet of the Apes franchise has a complicated history, right? The earlier classic, the first Planet of the Apes with Charlton Heston, was kind of cheesy, but also kind of brilliant, very much of its time. And then there were like, what, five different versions that were made at that time. And then Tim Burton made that horrible 90s reboot, which, you know, died before it even began. And I think the reason this works is because not only does it not retreat the same ground, it's almost a prequel. It is a prequel as well as a reboot. And because it uses the tropes but tells new stories, I think it has a really legitimate reason for existing.
No, I was going to say the same thing. I was going to use Planet of the Apes as an example because, you know, when watching the old movies, they are apes, but they are more humanoid than ape. And they're sort of like people that look like monkeys. This new franchise sort of made it Planet of the Apes with apes as actual apes. They literally threw monkeys going wild and learning how to speak and learning how to form civilizations on screen. So I think that's what a reboot has to do. It has to be, I don't think it has to sort of follow the older movies or whatever it's trying to reboot or remake. It has to add something that was not in the older franchise, but the older franchise could have used to its advantage. So I think Planet of the Apes is one. Spider-Man is definitely one because the complaint with the older Spider-Mans were that he's too old. Spider-Man needs to be a kid. That's the whole premise. He needs to be a kid in high school and he needs to have high school kid problems, but he also needs to be a Spider-Man when he's in the mask, which is something that only the Tom Holland series sort of brought. And the other two, like Andrew Garfield and Tobey Maguire, sort of failed on that front. So I think when you can do that for your reboots, then people will sort of accept it. If you rebooted just doing the same thing for like a cash grab, like some of the horror films, then it becomes forgettable.
I can get behind technology, especially for something like Planet of the Apes, where it was stupendous, right? And you're basically seeing the culmination of all these different moments of Andy Serkis's career, basically leading up to him being able to play this, leading up to his ability to perform it, leading up to the technology being able to match up to what he could do. So for that reason, I completely get it. But I think the other thing is that reboots walk a tricky line because the stories that they tell have to be timeless enough that they would appeal to people in the 70s and now, and that you can update reasonably well. But that timelessness also means that sometimes it can be very tricky to refresh, or to refresh while feeling as if it's justified, as opposed to it's just like, oh, turns out the world is feminist now. Crazy, huh? Let's just do this. And I think that is the common complaint against reboots or remakes that have that gender swapping thing, right? That tends to be the most common complaint. It's that this only exists because of Me Too and woke culture, which I don't agree with. I think actually, in some cases, sure. But in others, and I'm thinking here of something like Charlie's Angels, where you can see very specific iterations of what it means to be a 70s Charlie's Angel, and then an early 2000s Destiny's Child soundtrack Charlie's Angels, and then a modern, you know, Elizabeth Banks directed Charlie's Angels, and all those things look different. And I know that I'm talking about movies that are of, some would say, middling quality, but I think in those instances, you can kind of see how that works.
As someone who is a huge, huge fan of the early 2000s Charlie's Angels, the first one more than the second, middling, how dare you, firstly.
I dare. I enjoy, but I dare.
But I will say that the wokeness of recasting films is, gender-based, you know, on an opposite gender is something that, so Ghostbusters obviously is the one that immediately comes to mind that got into so much, so many issues in terms of fans questioning its very existence. But as somebody who really, really enjoyed it, I really loved the old Ghostbusters, but I also equally loved the new one. And for me, I felt like the reboot was something that offered an insight or a way into a story that was very exciting in its own way, but different enough The characters were different. They weren't just, frame for frame remakes of the same characters, but just cast as females. I thought that that made a good case for existing without necessarily just being, something that's a very unpopular choice as it is, the idea of it being a female Bond, for instance.
Speaking of female Bond, is Casino Royale a reboot of the franchise? Because
it's not reboots every time there's a new actor, doesn't it?
That's the thing. So every time there's a new actor, it sort of explores different elements of James Bond's either career or his villains or the bad guys or whatever. But Casino Royale, I think, was the first one that reinvented what 007 means. They also showed us his backstory. The whole franchise, like the Daniel Craig stuff, showed us where he grew up and why he decided to become a secret agent. And it also brought a lot of progressive themes into the franchise because of Daniel Craig, I think. So is that a reboot? It kind of soft rebooted 007.
I'm inclined to say yes, simply because a variety of things. He was blonde. I remember that being a huge deal, the fact that there was suddenly a blonde James Bond. But also the crunchiness of that movie, right? Like, it was very smooth, but he was also a return to he was a pivot away from the Pierce Brosnan, Roger Moore, kind of vein of James Bond and a little bit more, I will engage in fisticuffs. So, I would say so. But let us know whether you agree or disagree. We're talking today about reboots, specifically looking at movies, TV or shows rather, and careers in general, and just this idea of rejuvenating oneself. Let us know what your favorites or least favorites have been. You can WhatsApp 018-789-8899. You can tweet us at BFM Radio, and you can of course call 7733-2900. We'll be right back after the 8 o'clock news. BFM 89.9.
Brainy, fancy material. BFM 89.9.
Aunties? Are you here? I need your
help. I frankly don't care what you need, Sabrina. But I'll tell you what I need. An explanation for why a spellman was practicing necromancy on a mortal boy in Greendale.
She knows everything, love.
And why she would drag other witches into her reckless, stupid, selfish plans.
I did it for Harvey.
Did you? And tell me, did he ask you to do it? No. Because no one in their right mind would do what you did. How did you even know what spell to use? Ambrose says he didn't give it to you.
I didn't.
Miss Wardwell.
She gave it to you.
No, I took a book from her office.
Oh, so you're a thief as well as a murderer.
It is the return of our Thursday Supercuts. And today we are talking about reboots because the whole world is in a state of reboot right now, or in various states of reboot. Nobody's figured it out. And so we started off by talking about how, oh, by the way, it's Lynn Sharmilan Arvind. Sorry, it's out of practice. Yes. So we started off by talking about how the industry is looking at rebooting, hopefully with Christopher Nolan's Tenet in July. Then we spoke about what makes for a good movie franchise reboot. And now we're going to focus on television. So if you'd like to weigh in, we'd love to hear from you, either on when you feel you'll be ready to go back to the cinema or on your favorite or least favorite reboot of any sort. You can WhatsApp 018-789-8899 and tweet us at BFM Radio if you want. You can call 7733-2900.
We have a couple of messages on Twitter. This comes from Ryan, who says Battlestar Galactica, and then it has a GIF of Battlestar Galactica. there's also one from Var, who says Yamato 2199. I hadn't heard of it, so I had to Google it, and it stands for Star Blazer Space Battleship Yamato 2199, which is an anime. And then there's one from That's My Full Name, who says 911, more sexy and thrilling than Rescue 911. I didn't know Rescue 911 had a reboot.
Interesting.
I think this gets at the heart of what we were talking about earlier, which was this technology, the fact that sometimes when you remake something, it's occasionally just better simply because you have the tech now to make it look the way you want to. And I think that's particularly true of things like sci-fi, fantasy, anime. They fall into that category. But the other thing that I did want to talk about was procedurals get rebooted all the time. They are, I think, by far the most rebooted thing, you know, whether or not it's TV shows about cops or specific subsects of cops, about, you know, cops in different towns. We are seeing a lot of them. Hawaii Five-O, MacGyver, those are just the ones that come immediately to mind, but there are loads.
I think there is a timelessness to these stories. I mean, you can, you know, it doesn't have to be Don Johnson with a mullet and loud shirts, but at the end of the day, and the pulled up blazer, you know, arms or whatever, but you can transplant that storyline otherwise pretty easily into any era, because there's always crime and they're always cops and they're always somehow cooler than the rest of us, at least on screen. And, you know, honestly, a lot of real life heroes as well. So I think it's a storyline that resonates with everybody at any point in time.
See, I don't know. I'm not so sure. Because like stuff like Hawaii Five-O and MacGyver, I don't know anyone who actually watches those shows. I think they're just on air to like either fill up time or maybe...
It's a nostalgia thing. They're actually appealing to the people who like the old shows.
But do people who like the old shows actually watch the new shows? Because I don't know if anyone follows up. I know that Hawaii Five-O and you know, stuff like MacGyver used to be huge like way back when.
So the new Hawaii Five-O actually has its own subset of fans, and they're not necessarily people who used to watch the old one.
So like new
fans. Yes, I know people who are huge fans of Hawaii Five-O, really enjoy it.
Huh. Okay. Because I was just wondering, because, you know, like shows, I guess like not novelty shows, like slightly higher production shows, like things on streaming services and things like Westworld. I know those get a lot of following, but... things like CSI, Hawaii Five-O, I know they're on air for like a long, long, long time, but I've never wondered, you know, how well they do or who watches them. Do they have like a legion of followers, you know, who keep up with like every episode, or is it just something that you turn on the TV and if it's going on, you watch it? Because it's just that sort of like, it's designed to be watchable TV.
I actually think this might be a conversation, a larger conversation about watching TV or TV habits in general, mm-hmm. because these are all network shows. So I think the reason why they tend to escape our attention so much is because they're network shows, so they fit into a very old-fashioned mold of what TV is. And I don't just mean procedurals. I mean that they are reliably 42 minutes. They will have a certain amount of ad breaks, and they are written so that they can be cut for the breaks. Whereas a lot of us are now used to streaming episodes, which might vary in length, which drop all at once. And so the ones that tend to get our attention are the quote-unquote prestige TV, right? Or the big releases. And these don't fall into that category. I think they're just sort of quietly successful on network TV terms.
Mm. I also think that idea of building on someone's nostalgia, you know, it can be really hit or miss, because my mom, for instance, was very excited about rewatching Hawaii Five-O and, you know, going back to talking about Charlie's Angels, because she used to be such a fan of the series, she always wants to watch every new edition of the movie that comes up because there's a huge nostalgic value for her. But for someone like me, who was hugely, hugely into 90210 when I was, you know, preteen, I guess, I was not at all interested in watching the new ones. I would have maybe watched a reunion quite excitedly. I was not interested in watching a reboot of the show because for me it had no value.
I do think we should mention at this point that we started off with a clip from The Chilling Adventures of, is it New Sabrina? Is that the full title of the show?
Yes,
it's a bit of a lengthy one compared to, and that of course is a reboot of, I would call it an intellectual property more than anything, because it's a reboot of Sabrina as opposed to Melissa Joan Hart's Sabrina.
So I suppose the first TV version that came out, which is the Melissa Joan Hart one in the 90s, that's the adaptation of the comics, the Archie comics Sabrina. And then this would be now technically a reboot because it's a new version of that story. I think it's great. So I think that, again, fits into that what we were talking about earlier. It does something that the old show couldn't, partly because the old show was very much directed at a particular age group. This Sabrina is much darker, goes places that the Melissa Joan Hart version never could have gone. You know, it's still funny. It has all of the supernatural elements, but it really pushes it. And it is really a TV show that I think could only be made today. So I think that kind of justifies its reason for existing.
I think the same applies to Westworld. because Westworld is a reboot, but it's based on something that not a lot of people saw at the time. So it's able to sort of make its own stories and go its own way and come up with its own plot and stuff. But I think Westworld was something that was meant to come out today when, you know, CGI was, you know, is at this level and, you know, you can build those sort of landscapes in computers. I don't know if Westworld worked as well or it was not as famous because it came out at the time when they didn't have the technology to do it. So that's another example. I think it's something that, you know, lots of people watch Westworld, and it's only something that could have come out in the last 5 years, because before that it would have either looked clunky or cheap, and it might have ended up on like network TV or cable TV as one of those things like those Hawaii Five that you just could switch on and watch because it's episodic and it would go on for 6 or 7 seasons. But, you know, you might not have to watch every single episode to get what's going on, or you might not have to latch onto the show to, you know, understand it completely.
One thing about TV that I find particularly fascinating in terms of this idea of the reboot is shows that are trying to reboot themselves even as they are going on. So, for example, shows that reboot themselves in season 8, you know, especially once you have old stalwarts that are well-loved and then they are killed off or they leave or whatever. And then you have to kind of try to do your show, but with new characters. And I think it's a very interesting thing simply because it's one where people either accept it or they don't, right? And very often you will see a certain amount of discomfort from viewers because I think TV is different. They come into your home, you watch them week in, week out. So you build a certain sense of familiarity. And then when you introduce new people, it's a whole delicate balance. So I think shows that are trying to reboot themselves even as they're going on have a particularly hard challenge. And I'm thinking here of shows like, we spoke about Community earlier this week, Community, also Scrubs, you know, things like that.
Scrubs is one that I didn't realize they were going to do it. I was very, I kind of thought the show was ending, and that's the direction it went in. And then it basically decided, oh, we're just going to bring in a new crop of doctors. And it's kind of like a spin-off, but it's not. It's kind of like a sequel, but it's not. It's kind of a reboot, but it's not. It didn't work for me, primarily because I think, much like Christopher Nolan's Tenet, it was too soon. You know, you didn't have a separation from the show that you loved before you were expected to like a whole bunch of characters just because the characters that you loved from before were cameoing in the new version. It felt like a cheat.
Did it end like 2 seasons later?
It did. It had a very short-lived quote-unquote reboot.
So we brought up something when thinking about, you know, the today's subject, and Star Trek was one of it. You mentioned Star Trek, and you said that, you know, all of its different series act as reboots because they all work on different timelines. I think a lot of shows wanted to copy that concept, but because they didn't have time travel to mess around with, they couldn't.
So CSI does it though, right? Quite CSI successfully. Does it. They just plant them in different states, and then it kind of works.
Yeah, but also those are happening on adjacent timelines, because it's like one guy could be in Miami and the other one's happening in like New York, and then someone's in, I don't know where the original one is, because it doesn't say in the title, but
Vegas.
Vegas, yeah. So Star Trek does that because they have the ability to sort of reboot without affecting whatever the main timeline is, and no one knows what the main timeline is. Like, is it Enterprise? Is it the new Picard? Or is it Discovery? And so they get to play around with all those different ideas, and if it fails, it fails. And it doesn't touch the original series or the show. It doesn't affect it in any way, I think. Even the movies sort of played around with it a bit and then forgot about it halfway through.
A multiverse is a convenient thing to have, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah.
When you want to make use of it.
And it's no surprise that they're the ones that get rebooted so much, because comics and sci-fi are just ripe for that kind of reimagining. Mm.
Before we move on, last mention, and I think that was something that Sharmila brought up as well previously, which was Queer Eye.
Yes.
I think it's quite notable because Queer Eye removed for the straight guy from the reboot. And I think that was part of their 20, when did it come out? 18, 19? That was part of their late 20 boost of inclusivity.
And also the sense that, so the previous Queer Eye, which I was like this avid follower of, I bought their books, I watched their shows, was very much about those five aspects, the fashion, the cooking and whatever. Whereas the new version expands on that, and it's a much more touchy-feely, late 2000s, 2020 kind of show where it's all about transforming your, you know, your mindfulness and all of this as well. And I think that that's actually also a formula that possibly you could revive again and again, you know, 20 years from now, you could redo it and people would still identify with it.
So we're talking right now about reboots, specifically in the vein of TV shows or shows in general. I don't know what to call them anymore. They're not often on television. But also about the concept of reboots as a whole, whether it's in terms of movie franchises. After this, we're going to be talking about careers, actors who have just kind of changed things around entirely. Let us know what your favorite or least favorite reboots have been and why. You can WhatsApp 018-789-8899. You can tweet us at BFM Radio. And you can, of course, also call 7733-2900. You're listening to Popcorn Culture on BFM 89.9.
Business, finance, and music. BFM 89.9.
I lost everything. That dog was a final gift from my dying wife.
Jonathan, you got out once. You dip so much as a pinky back into this pond, you may find something reaching out to pull you back in.
It's personal.
Where'd you get that car?
What does it matter?
It's not what you did, son. It's who you did it to.
The nobody?
That nobody. It's John Wick.
It is 8:23. You are listening to Popcorn Culture with Lynn, Sharmila, and Arvin. And today we're talking about the concept of rebooting in light of the fact that we're all attempting to do that. We've spoken about that in terms of the industry itself, in terms of movies, in terms of television. If you would like to share a favorite or least favorite version of a reboot, because there have been so very many, you can WhatsApp 018-789-8899 and tweet us at BFM Radio. And as you can tell, we just heard John Wick, or the introduction of Baba Yaga. And that I think is, I don't know, I mean, Keanu Reeves has always been a successful actor, but we are seeing him rebooted right now, I guess, in terms of him being super hyper action man and John Wick and internet darling.
I mean, I think Keanu Reeves is actually quite special, because if you look at his career, he's actually rebooted himself in several ways over and over. I mean, he was like California, like Bill and Ted stoner for ages. And then he there was that phase where he was doing romantic roles. And then he went on to being, of course, you know, Neo in Matrix. And then there was a kind of lull for a while. So I just think that it's his overall nice guy off-screen persona that allows him to reinvent himself so many times, because I think people watch Keanu Reeves in anything.
I just think it's because he's so cool. It's like, you know, I mean, just listen to that clip where, you know, someone attacked his dog and then he goes after them. I think, you know, whatever he's doing, or whatever, whoever his PR people are and what they are doing for him, they're doing it perfectly, because he's like all over the place. After John Wick, he was in Toy Story 4. Then he cameoed in that movie on Netflix. I cannot remember the name.
The Ali Wong film.
Yes, that one. And then he's also in like video games, because he showed up as like a surprise guest in Cyberpunk 2077. So he's going to be in that video game as well. So yeah, if like anyone's having a reboot career now, it's him. And I don't know, I honestly don't know why. Like, besides him becoming a meme before that, like after The Matrix, there was a lull for a while. He was a meme for like a long, long time. And then suddenly he popped back up in John Wick. And I don't know why John Wick, but something about those movies and something about the way he looks or dresses or carries himself has made him like super, super famous over the last 5 years.
Isn't that, you know, similar to Liam Neeson in Taken? Mm-hmm. You know, before that, especially because his wife had died and all, he'd kind of taken this whole huge backstep. And then the Taken was that sort of huge action franchise. And there are a lot of parallels, because it's also an older star reinventing himself in a particular way. And that kind of then launched the whole Liam Neeson as the cool old action hero trope. Mm-hmm.
But you know what I like about that comparison also is that, well, Liam Neeson was a very serious actor, you know, prior to becoming the guy with the very special set of skills and the constantly missing family. Prior to that, he was a prestige actor for the longest time. And now what he's done is he's rebooted himself into a guy who is really the same character. You know, he's somebody who can kill you no matter where he is or what he's doing. But I think someone like Matthew McConaughey is kind of interesting as well, because of course there was the McConaissance of a couple of years ago. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And he did it the other way around, where and I think that's the more common attempt, where it's somebody who maybe did more comedy, more action, and then they are the ones who are trying to like crack that prestige. And so and Matthew McConaughey did it that way around. I like the fact that Keanu Reeves has kind of maintained a certain sameness to what he does.
But I don't think anyone's sort of reboot beats Robert Downey Jr.'s, because he's gone, like, he's become so much of Tony Stark and, you know, Mr. MCU that people forget that Robert Downey Jr. had a career before he was exiled from Hollywood. Because he was that guy. Like, he was, you know, quickly becoming, like, that guy in Hollywood where he would have all these, like, prestige films. He was doing all these indie roles. He was also doing, like, action roles. He was doing, I think he was in a couple of rom-coms or just romantic dramas. So, you know, he was on that rise before he made a couple of bad decisions and, you know, Hollywood just sort of spat him out, and then he wasn't that low. I mean, Jon Favreau had to like argue with the guys at Marvel to have him as Tony Stark. The producers behind the MCU didn't want him there because he was problematic and because he didn't have that value anymore. But, you know, just thinking about that now and looking at where he is, like him, Downey and his wife are producing shows and they're producing movies. And he is, I think he is the highest or the second highest paid actor in Hollywood. It's either him or The Rock. So, you know, it's one of the two guys. And, you know, just being the face of Marvel Studios and just being Iron Man, I don't think anyone's reboot is as strong or as powerful as what Downey has done to himself or, you know, just what Marvel has done for him.
I think Robert Downey Jr. also, you know, is a reboot in that sense that I was a big fan of pre-Stark, Robert Downey Jr., addiction issues and Hollywood pariah and all that. It was, and I loved that Robert Downey Jr. I loved Chaplin. I even loved his arc in Ally McBeal. You know, he was that guy. To me, this Robert Downey Jr., I mean, I love him. He's great, but it's almost like they're two different people. I don't recognize him as the same actor somebody who uses the same skill set at all.
Well, that leads me actually to this idea of bankability, because I think whether or not you can reboot yourself is completely dependent on whether or not the box office backs you up. And so I think that if Robert Downey Jr. had not been in a wildly successful Marvel movie and then went on to become the guy who could film his scenes in, like, I don't know, 45 minutes because he's not actually there. Mm-hmm. You know, if he hadn't had the bankability behind that, the fact that there were these actual, you know, dollars and cents success, it would have been a lot harder for that reboot. And I think about this in terms of, I mean, I have a well-documented fondness and I bring her up at all opportunities, Katharine Hepburn, and how for the very longest time, the term applied to her was box office poison, you know, because she was in a series of movies that just did not make money. And then I think I never thought I would say this, but similar to Robert Downey Jr., you know, she found the role, she found a version of a role that made her a star. And I think it's in both cases, they tap into something very inherent about the actor themselves. I think Robert Downey Jr. and Tony Stark, like we've said, indistinguishable at this point. You watch him in interviews and it's like you're watching Tony Stark. And with Katharine Hepburn, it was a particular sort of acidic, acerbic, smart, fast-talking, almost arrogant woman. And, you know, she ended up playing either that or the fallen version of that. But the point is she had an archetype and that rescued her from box office poison and pushed her into stardom. And that allowed the reboot. So I think we shouldn't ignore the importance of two things, I guess. One is finding your role and the other is just money.
Speaking of finding your role, isn't that the same thing that happened to The Rock, like Dwayne Johnson? Because he was, for a long time, he was like Disney's failure. Like he had a long contract with Disney, so he was like in The Tooth Fairy and The Game Plan and a couple of other movies that didn't do well at all after transitioning from wrestling. And it was at that time when he sort of doubled his size, like literally, and then started taking these action roles and producing his own movies that he became this star. Because he's not the best actor out there, but he knows how to act his type. Like he knows his role and he knows how to play that one kind of person. And that's why he's called like franchise steroids, because any franchise that needs like saving or rebooting, sort of you employ The Rock and he just takes it to like a whole other level.
I do think also that, and I'm glad that you brought up Katharine Hepburn, because I feel like this reboot happens a lot less for women. I think female actresses have a particular niche that they are forced to occupy. If I'm thinking of like a Meg Ryan or a Julia Roberts, who find it very difficult to transition to doing anything else. And that's why I wanted to bring up Laura Dern, because she's someone who in just the last 3 or 4 years has had some massive hits. And, first of all, there's Star Wars. She was in The Last Jedi, but she was in Marriage Story. She was in Big Little Lies. She was was nominated for an Oscar. And the thing was, back in the 90s, when she was David Lynch's sort of muse and was in so many of his films, and then she appeared on the Ellen's Coming Out episode, and that was kind of the poison to her career. She was in Jurassic Park, but after that, she didn't do much work at all. Mm-hmm. And I think it's to add to Lynn's list of bankability and what was the other one that you said? Finding a persona, finding the role. I think talent actually speaks quite a bit, but also the opportunity that exists now for female actresses. So even, say, actors of color, the ability to make roles, that didn't exist before.
So in closing, I just wanted to wind all the way back to what we spoke about at the start, which is this notion of being able to restart cinemas, being able to go back to watch movies. We did kind of say where we stood. Have your minds changed? Do you feel any differently now than you did an hour ago? Are you planning to go back to the cinema in July for Tenet and Mulan, if in fact they do open then?
Both of those movies might convince me. I feel like they might. Maybe I'll find the super like quiet cinema that nobody goes to and think about it.
Everyone thinks they have one of those and then everyone's going to go there.
Sanitize myself after I come home.
I don't know. I Tenet's the one movie that I would, I don't want to say risk, but Tenet's the one movie that's the problem. If they move Tenet, I don't think I'd have any problem waiting for the next 4 or 5 months for the next big release to come out. I'm not rushing for anything, even if it's Mulan, even if it's, a couple of other big movies. But Tenet's the one that I will have to sort of like 50-50 and take my bets and sort of, I don't know. I don't want to wear a mask to the cinema because it just ruins the vibe, but I don't know.
I think our vibes are going to be very, very different whenever it is that we finally make our way back to the cinema, regardless. But yeah, I agree. I could be convinced. I could be convinced. It's a long way away. It's a month and a half. So yeah, if and when Mulan and Tenet do make their way to our shores, you can be sure that we will be talking about it then. But in the meantime, we've spent this episode talking about the notion of reboots. If you would like to get in touch, please do. You can WhatsApp 018-789-8899. Tweet us at BFM Radio. You can also write to us at movies@bfm.my. And if you want updates, now that we're back on a regular schedule, if you want updates or to message us on social media, you can find us. We are BFM Popcorn on both Twitter and Instagram. We'll be back next week. You've been listening to Popcorn Culture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.